Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. What kind of lunch can you buy for $3? A bag of chips and a soda? A single organic apple? The federal government allots only $2.93 for each school lunch.
Our vision and our goal from the beginning was healthy, affordable, delicious food for all kids.
And only 8% of low-income students actually get a college degree. Are high schools making the grade when it comes to college prep?
They've been working blindly, right? Not knowing what's happening to their kids once they get to college.
Today, we're speaking with Revolution Foods co-founders Kristen Richmond and Kirsten Tobey, and founder of Beyond 12, Alex Bernadotte. Nurturing the next generation for success with hot food and high tech. That's our inflection point. You're listening to Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. My guest is Alexandra Bernadotte, founder and CEO of Beyond 12. Alex Bernadotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Beyond 12 and why you founded it.
So we are a national nonprofit organization. Our mission is to increase the number of low-income and first-generation students who graduate from college. And we do that in three ways. We track students, we connect students, and we coach students. The first piece of the work is the tracking. We've built an alumni tracker that allows us to collect all kinds of data about how kids are doing once they get to college. It's everything from, did they show up on day one? What are their grades? Have they made any meaningful connections on campus? Are they utilizing campus's resources? And we synthesize all of that information and we feed it back to their high schools or the programs that they work with to help them make decisions about how effective their models were. So now if you're a high school, you have access to information like, you know, what percentage of my students failed freshman math? What percentage of my students had to be remediated in English once they got there? What are my kids' GPAs? How long on average is it taking my kids to graduate from college? Where are they going to college? You know, that kind of information that's really valuable for you as you're trying to build your model and as you're trying to figure out whether you're effective or not.
As a high school.
As a high school or as a scholarship organization or as an after-school program like the Boys and Girls Club, you know. So anybody who's working at the high school level to get kids into college, they've been working blindly, right? Not knowing what's happening to their kids. Once they get to college. And so really the point that we're trying to make is let's use data. Let's use actual student data, not just college data, but workforce entry data to help reform your practices rather than conventional wisdom. But I started the organization in large part to address some of the challenges that I faced as a first-generation college goer. I was born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. I grew up in inner city Boston. My parents did not have a college degree, but they knew that the college degree was really our path out of poverty, our path to a better future. So they stressed the importance without really necessarily having the tools to allow me to follow that dream. But I always had that as the motivation and the inspiration. My mom used to work in the emergency room of a hospital, and one day she came running home after overhearing a group of doctors talking about where they were sending their kids to college. And so she came running home and said, you have to go to this thing called an Ivy League, and you have to go to this place called Dartmouth, you know, which is how she pronounced it initially.
I can only imagine what she was visualizing with Ivy League.
And she had
right?
no idea what she was talking about. It's just, it was the, like, this is what I heard the doctors talking about. It seems like it's important and the path to go, and that's where you should go. So that's how the dream of a specific college was born, you know, through that overheard conversation. So I worked really hard, did everything that I was supposed to do. And coincidentally, I did land at this Dartmouth place and eventually realized it was pronounced Dartmouth. But I landed there and we all celebrated the moment because we felt like we had won. We had won the lottery because that's what it was all about, that it was about getting in. But we were wrong. I went to Hanover, New Hampshire, totally unprepared for what lay ahead. And I had a very horrible and difficult transition from high school to college and quickly discovered that getting that college acceptance letter was really only the first step. You know, in many ways was the easiest step. So luckily, my story has a happy ending. So I was able to turn things around and I did graduate from Dartmouth and did become the first person in my immediate family to earn a college degree. But unfortunately, that's not the story for lots and lots of students with backgrounds and stories similar to mine. So each year, hundreds and thousands of kids, armed with their college acceptance letters, you know, embark on their college journeys, believing like I did that they're prepared for the road ahead. But the statistics tell us otherwise. They're actually not prepared. Only 8% of students from the lowest income quartile can expect to earn a bachelor's degree by their mid-20s versus 82% of students from the highest income quartile.
Do you need to then be connected with both the high school and then the colleges that those graduates eventually go to? Who are you working with?
Yeah, so it's both. Our point of entry into the market are the high schools or the high school-based organizations. And I say high school-based organizations because of a lot of our partners aren't high schools. So they'll, like I said, after school programs or scholarship organizations. But yeah, so our point of entry are those institutions. We call them pre-collegiate organizations. Then it's their alumni. So all of the kids that they're serving, that they're sending off to college. And then by extension, the colleges and universities where they're sending critical masses of their kids. So that's how the equation works. It's from the high school-based programs to their kids to the colleges and universities where they're sending critical masses of their kids.
Alex, who pays for all of this?
We are a nonprofit, but we are a revenue-generating nonprofit, which means that we get about 40% of our revenue right now comes from the fees, the annual subscription fee and the per-student fee that our partners pay, whether they be high schools or after-school organizations or colleges. And so they're paying for these services and for the subscription. And then the other piece, 60% right now, comes from philanthropy. So institutional funders, foundations, individual donors. We wanted to create a sustainable nonprofit. You know, we wanted it to be nonprofit because we wanted to always be driven and guided by our mission, but we also wanted to be sustainable. So our goal is to get to 85% earned income. So 85% of our income will come from these fees that our partners are paying us and only rely on philanthropy for the R&D, the special projects, and the technology, and for us not to have to rely on philanthropy in perpetuity and to really build a sustainable, scalable model that demonstrates to the field that a nonprofit can actually be sustainable and scalable and doesn't have to rely on philanthropy in perpetuity.
Is that kind of a groundbreaking new approach to a nonprofit model?
It definitely is. I mean, I think there are some, you know, there are some models out there. The Salvation Army is one, right, in terms of what in a nonprofit that's revenue generating. But there aren't a lot of organizations with that model, and certainly not many in education. And so it is. We wanted to do this in a groundbreaking way, partly because I don't like to fundraise, but partly because, yeah, we do feel like this is the next step in terms of models. Organizations have to demonstrate that they are sustainable. You know, I often say that your tax status is not a business model, right? And so whether you're a nonprofit or for-profit, that's not a business model. You actually have to have a business model that demonstrates how you're going to sustain yourself and how you're going to grow the business. And for us, we really wanted to be able to create that example of an education organization that blends technology and service, but that also blends earned revenue with philanthropy to really scale the model.
And the earned revenue is really proof of concept, because clearly these institutions are finding value in what you're bringing to
them. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So after you realized that this was an opportunity that you could pursue and you knew that it was something that you wanted to make into something bigger, was going to Stanford the thing that said that helped you feel like it was something you could actually go and create? I mean, was that, do you feel like it's something you could have done without attending business school?
So, and I actually didn't go to business school. I actually went to the education school. So I got a policy degree.
Okay.
And so, yes and no. You know, I knew that I had this idea. I knew that I needed to, even if not the very specific skills that that graduate degree would provide and offer, but the networks. Right. And so I knew that I needed that. And quite frankly, as a woman, I felt like I needed the credentials. And I could be the exact same person that I am today with the exact same idea. But the fact that I can say, oh, yeah, I have a graduate degree from Stanford adds some legitimacy, even though it shouldn't, right, to the process. And it added legitimacy when I was approaching funders, when I was, you know, approaching organizations' initial clients. And so for me, I had a very sort of strong understanding of that before going to Stanford, and I felt like I needed the networks and the credentials. So that was definitely it. But I do think that the more pivotal piece of the story in terms of starting Beyond 12 was that experience that I had working at New Schools Venture Fund. So right after I decided that I wanted to launch Beyond 12, I officially left. But they came back and said, hey, this is something that's really important to us and the organizations in our portfolio. We'll create this position called an entrepreneur in residence, and we will provide you with the support. So the mentors who can help you think through this, a ready group of organizations who are going to be thought partners and potentially early adopters, and funding, you know, which is not something that a lot of entrepreneurs have the opportunity to do. So through that residency, I had 10 months of support in all of the ways that I talked to you, financial and also beyond to the dollars, that allowed me to really focus in on this idea, create the business plan, vet it by a bunch of different people in the field and in the industry. But I had that support. And I do think that that was critical in launching Beyond 12, because I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't have that opportunity.
So what were some of the obstacles that you ran into as you were putting Beyond 12 together?
Oh my gosh, so many. How much time do we have?
It wasn't just a breeze. You didn't just snap your fingers and suddenly.
Of course, I snapped my fingers and suddenly it all appeared and Beyond 12 was created. Lots of different obstacles. I think for me, there are two things, and I don't often like to focus on this, but I think we need to be real about who I am and where I come from. I am a woman, and I am a woman of color. So I did not have those networks. I couldn't go to mom and dad and borrow money. I didn't have a rich uncle somewhere who was ready to fund this venture for me. And so I needed access to capital, and I needed access to mentors, you know, folks who had done this work before and who would be able to guide me and provide me with the insights that they had learned as they were trying to start organizations, which is why this EIR opportunity was critical, because it gave me both. So lots of the challenges. It was, you know, again, trying to find seed capital, trying to find funders who were willing to sort of believe in this idea when it was just a nugget, finding talent and access to talent. So trying to find folks who were willing to jump on board in the early days before, you know, again, they knew or I knew that this was actually going to take off. Oh, God, trying to change our education system, you know, that systemic change piece is really, really tough. It's an intractable institution with lots of very entrenched interests. And so trying to say, oh, I'm going to create something that just changes the paradigm and changes these systems was incredibly difficult. So getting buy-in, you know, credibility, legitimacy. So all of those things were really difficult. And another piece of it, I wanted to have a family. So I was starting Beyond 12 and at the same time gave birth to a son, you know, simultaneously. And I'd like to congratulate myself for not killing either of them. You know,
I'll
both
congratulate
thriving.
You.
Thank you.
As well.
Pat me on the back. They're both thriving, which is great. But there was a moment there that I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And I think a very difficult challenge of trying to fundraise while, you know, 8 months pregnant and having funders look at me and say, are you actually going to come back? Why don't I hold off a little bit and see what happens in, you know, a few months and whether you are actually committed to this, which was, you know, an interesting challenge in and of itself. So
was that the feedback that you were getting when you walked in the room fully pregnant?
So for those who gave me feedback, yes, right. And there was a lot of feedback that I did not get, and a lot of, you know, opportunities that I felt were really sort of prime and ripe, you know, but for whatever reason, they didn't work out. But I did have a few people who were very honest with me and who said, you know what, like, this is a new organization. This all rests on your shoulders, you know, as the founder. And I'm going to be honest. I don't know are you going to come back? Are you going to be committed to this? Are you going to be dedicated to this? How much time are you going to be able to spend on this? While I appreciated the honesty, it left me thinking about the other end of the equation, right? If I were a male, and I didn't have this very visible signal that I was starting a family, would I have received the same questions? And would I have experienced the same kind of downturn or pause in our fundraising efforts?
So how did you deal with that?
I guess the only way we know how, you kind of keep trucking and keep moving on, right? It's like there's nothing else to do but to keep going back to. I'm excited, and I was happy that I had a very good group of committed early investors who I could go back to and who were like, okay, yeah, I'm committed to you and committed to your vision. But it was hard. It was very difficult. And trying to sort of, you know, be calm and be stress-free, you know, because I'm carrying this child and I want to create a zen environment, but also worrying about payroll? You know, am I going to be able to pay my employees? What's going to happen to the organization? Is this going to be sustainable? Am I going to be able to sort of move past this? How much maternity leave do I take? And it was great. I was in a position to write my maternity leave policy, but I also had to match that against what the expectations were externally and what I felt like I could afford to do as a founder. And then I dealt with it the only other way that I could. I called mom and dad and said, help, come move in with me. So they moved in with us for a year to help me take care of Lucas.
So you've now created this organization. You are the leader of this organization. Do you feel like you are a natural leader, or is that something that you had to learn how to do?
I think it was a little bit of both. If I go back and I think about just childhood and all of those experiences, I felt like I, in many ways, marched to the beat of my own drums. I felt like I also grew up just because of the environment in which I grew up. My parents were immigrants, and so the daughter of immigrants, and I was born in Haiti, so I'm an immigrant, I guess, for all intents and purposes. You often find yourself in a lot of roles, having to translate for parents, having to sort of help them navigate the system. And so I think you develop a certain amount of maturity and leadership that is probably far ahead of your peers in terms of just the kinds of situations that you have to help navigate and you have to translate, right, into world. So I do feel like that there was a certain amount of that, that I think is a result of just the environment in which I grew up and probably some genetics, right? I come from a very strong line of powerful women. My grandmother is a very powerful figure, and my parents moved to the U.S. when I was 3 months old, and they left me in her care. And so I knew her as my mom, you know, from the very beginning, and she's played a very pivotal role in my life. So I do think that I had the models, and that was probably one thing that was unique to me. But there are lots of other things about my leadership style that I had to learn. Like, what kind of leader do I want to be? What's my style? How do I inspire and encourage? And I think those are very deliberate decisions in terms of running an organization and in terms of the DNA and the culture that you want to set in an organization. So I think it's a little bit of both. There's a little bit of that's DNA, and others that other qualities and characteristics that you have to learn and that you have to be deliberate about learning.
So where did you look to figure out what kind of style you wanted to have? Was it about finding someone who you wanted to emulate, or a boss that you might have had earlier in your career?
I think it was probably more about the folks that I didn't want to be like,
right?
You know, so there was a combination of folks that I wanted to emulate, but I think I had a lot of experiences of folks that I didn't want to emulate. You know, I didn't want to be a screamer. You know, I had worked with people who just sort of communicated. The way that they communicated was just by yelling. And I just felt like the English language is so rich. You know, why do we need that? Why does that need to be the, right, the way that you encourage and inspire folks to act? So I had lots of bad examples, but I also had lots of great examples and good role models. So it was really just a matter of picking and choosing, but then also being authentic. Right, authentic to me, and knowing like what is it that I bring to the table, and how do I then combine some of those qualities and skills that I had seen in amazing people and in amazing leaders. And then I read a lot. You know, you read all of those management books about leadership to the point now where I'm just so inundated that I don't remember any of the key principles.
Right. But just read the table of contents.
Exactly. So I'm like, okay, wait, what am I supposed to do again? Am I building the bus? Am I on the boat, or whatever it is? But but I did a lot of reading as well, and a lot of research, and a lot of just sort of assessment, right? Internal assessment of my strengths and what are the things that I bring to the table.
We're talking to Alexandra Bernadotte, founder and CEO of Beyond 12. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. My guest is Alexandra Bernadotte, founder and CEO of Beyond 12. So, Alex Bernadotte, with Beyond 12, you are in a position to help girls focus on fields that they might traditionally shy away from. And you talked earlier about science and math, you know, being an area where everyone could probably learn a little bit more before they get to college. Is that something that you do?
It is something that we do without necessarily being as deliberate, right? And without necessarily talking about it. And I think we can probably do a better job of talking about it. So our focus, and when we think of the students that are target population, we say traditionally underrepresented groups, students who are first in their families or students who come from low-income backgrounds and low-income communities. But we do, the balance is usually skewed towards women. And so we probably... We're tracking the progress of about 43,000 college students right now, and I would say probably 65% are female. And so it is something that we do. We've actually just started a partnership with the California Wellness Foundation, where we are coaching students to increase the number of underserved students who are interested in the health professions, for instance. But when we look at the numbers, very heavily skewed towards women, the majority of our coaches are female. So it is something that we're doing, but we're not necessarily capturing it in the way that we probably should to be able to answer that question. And we probably should be a lot more deliberate about it. But it is definitely an impact that we're having. We're having an impact on women, and we're definitely having an impact through our coaching on women who are interested in the STEM fields.
So it's interesting that 65% of the students that you're helping are female. Is that because more girls are going to college than boys are going to college?
Yeah, so yes, it is. When we look at the demographics of the students that we're serving, there are definitely more women, underserved female students who are going to college than men. We're also working with a lot of organizations that are, you know, either after school programs or organizations that are working outside of school. And so they also tend to have more female participants in their programs than men. And this issue of, you know, underserved men and men of color and you know, STEM and college graduation is a huge one. So much so that the White House has created an initiative, My Brother's Keeper, around this. And so that is, I mean, we are a reflection of this greater education challenge, particularly as it relates to underserved students or students from low-income backgrounds.
Girls who are coming from the added challenge of an underserved community and who have the added challenge of having skin of color and who are confronting biases on multiple fronts as they face the world, but then also as they try and make their way through the college experience. How does Beyond 12 address that litany of issues?
It's an interesting thing. And I go back to the center and the focus for us is really around college graduation, not just earning the degree, but being able to provide them with a degree that allows them to change their economic and personal prospects. And that for many of the students that we serve, allow them to break the cycle of generational poverty. So that is really our focus. And that's where we go. And it does. I mean, our students wear multiple hats, right? And so our students from racial and ethnic backgrounds that haven't traditionally gone to college, our students are the first in their families to go to college. Our students are from underserved communities and under-resourced communities. We have students with disabilities, students who are English language learners, students who are undocumented, right? And so there are lots of different layers of challenges. And for us, I'm not sure we unpack all of those, really. The best way that we know how to address some of these issues is by hiring coaches who represent the demographics of the students that we're serving so that they are on a very personal level able to provide guidance that comes from a place of authenticity and that comes from a place of, oh yeah, I've been there, I understand the challenges, and let's figure out how to address them so that you're going to earn your college degree. And it's really interesting because even as I think about my own background, I don't know if I'm really able to unpack how much I feel in tune with my female side, right? Versus how much I feel in tune with the fact that I am a Black woman or how much I feel in tune with the fact that I'm from the Caribbean, you know, and I'm Caribbean American. I think it just all goes together, right? And I think it's holistic. It's who I am as a person. And I don't think I ever unpack those and deal with the challenges individually. And so for us, it's a holistic approach. And it's about ultimately, how do we help you earn this milestone that we know is going to change your life trajectory? And as challenges come up, we're just going to provide you with a guide, you know, with a guidance to address it, a knowledgeable guide who also has been through it and who can therefore offer personal insights and guidance about navigating it.
So Alex, what advice do you have for women who would like to start their own business, their own nonprofit? Where should they begin?
Well, this is my advice that I have for all entrepreneurs, not just women. Find a problem and solve the problem rather than being a solution in search of a problem, right? And so I think we often say, oh, I have this great idea for an app, or I have this great idea for a tool, or I have this great idea for an organization. And often it's not solving a problem, it's just a great idea. So advice number one is find a problem and build a solution for that problem or for that challenge rather than the other way around. I think the second one is really think about the value of networks. It's very difficult to do this alone. So figure out what you're going to need in order to be able to get that done. And for me, it was, you know, being incubated. And so there are lots of incubators out there of great ideas who are willing to provide the mentorship and the support. So see if you can align yourself, particularly as a woman and as a female entrepreneur, with those incubators so that you don't have to do the difficult work of trying to build something out of your garage, you know, and trying to build something piecemeal. And then the third one, somebody gave me this piece of advice, which has proved to be very, very helpful. Before you get to the moment when you want to start an organization, build this kitchen cabinet of advisors, right? Folks who you go to, who can provide you with just very sage advice, but also the other way around, folks that you're going to potentially be able to help in many ways. And I had built this kitchen cabinet and they became my first board of directors, right? And so they weren't, it wasn't awkward. I wasn't going to people and asking them to support me because they had already been in those roles and it was very easy to transition. But I felt like I had identified my mentors, identified these folks who were incredibly supportive and who were willing to open their networks for me. And I tapped into those resources, you know, as I was trying to launch Beyond 12. And then the last thing is really do your homework. This is really difficult, but it's inspiring and incredible work to be able to run your organization, to be able to take an idea from inception, you know, through fruition and implementation is amazing, but it's hard. You know, it's really difficult work. And so I would just suggest that women in particular do the homework, understand what's going to be required, understand what kind of skills you have and where might you fall short and how might you bring those other skills, whether through a co-founder or through your first hires, to help you round out all of the experiences that you need to have in order to successfully launch an organization.
Alex, before we sat down today, I asked you to bring a written word to share with us that inspires you. What did you bring with you and why?
So I am going to go with a personal inspiration. And one poem that I often go back to is a poem that, wow, somebody shared with me when I was very, very young. But it's Phenomenal Woman by Maya Angelou. And it's so interesting. I feel like whenever I'm having these moments of doubt, you know, whenever I'm having these moments where I feel like the world is just kicking me and I can't get a break and I need to somehow regain my, you know, my power, I go back and I read this poem and it does the trick every single time.
Okay, let's hear it.
Pretty women wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model size. But when I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That's me. It's the fire in my eyes and the flash of my teeth, the swing in my waist and the joy in my feet. I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That's me. Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hand, the need for my care. 'Cause I'm a woman, phenomenally. Phenomenal woman, that's me.
Alex Bernadotte, thank you for joining us. It was so great having you.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. We've all heard the expression, you are what you eat. Well, turns out, you are. As childhood obesity rates continue to rise in the United States, and as connections are drawn between food and academic performance, my guests Kristen Richmond and Kirsten Tobey co-founded Revolution Foods with the idea that they could get kids to actually eat food that's nutritious. They now serve 1.5 million healthy school meals a week. Kristen Richmond and Kirsten Tobey, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Excited to be here.
You've built Revolution Foods from an idea to an enterprise in just under 8 years.
That's right.
Okay. And you're now serving up over 1.5 million meals a week in schools. Could you talk about the mission, culture, and values that you started the company with? I understand it was a truly hands-on effort from the beginning.
It has been a hands-on effort, and actually, Kira and I have been working together for a full decade now on the business planning and getting this vision launched. But our vision and our goal from the beginning was to dramatically increase access to healthy, affordable, delicious food for all kids, and that really two tiers of that vision: quality food, and then access for all.
The underlying belief behind all of that was that we believe that all kids deserve access to high-quality, healthy food. And what we were seeing in schools is that not all kids have access to high-quality, healthy food, either in their schools or in their neighborhoods. So we, you know, wanted to set out to change that by making healthy food accessible first through schools, and now we're working on the broader community and neighborhood as well.
So, Kirsten, I've heard you talk about an industry that's turning out junk, because that's what kids like to eat. So how have you addressed that in taste of the food? I mean, you can create healthy food, but how do you actually get kids to like it when their taste palate is somewhere else?
Well, so kids will only eat food if they like the taste of it. And so we have really focused on the culinary side of developing and producing our food. So we have a team of chefs who are working day in and day out, talking to kids, working with kids, having kids taste our food, give feedback on the food. You know, it's just as important that our food be, you know, meet our high quality ingredient and health standards as that it tastes good, because it's only going to be, you know, have the impact that we want it to have if it's eaten by the kids. And so we have put a huge amount of effort behind our taste profiles. And people told us a lot in the beginning that kids, you know, will never eat healthy food because they just like junk food and they prefer the taste of junk food. And what we've realized is that if you make high quality food that kids, you know, like the taste of, they will eat it. And we have to give kids some credit that they actually love fresh fruit and love many fresh vegetables. And a lot of kids aspire to be chefs and, you know, love the fact that our food is prepared by chefs in a really thoughtful way.
So did you lay out a set of core values? This is our mission. This is how we want to be different. Could you talk a little bit about what that sounded like at then and maybe now?
Yeah, well, our mission has always been around not just making healthy food accessible, but also building lifelong healthy eaters. So enabling kids through our programs to be able to build healthy eating habits so that they're set up for success in the long term. And we've always had a fundamental belief in the link between, you know, building healthy eating habits and eating healthy food and sort of success in the long term in terms of both health, but also in, you know, academics. And you know, we see there's a lot of really important connections to be made between kids eating something healthy when they go to school or before they go to school, when they're at school, and how much they're able to focus and concentrate and do well in school. And so I think that belief in forming healthy eating habits was always a really important part of what we were doing. And also belief in respecting kids as a part of the process. You know, that's always been a part of our DNA is, you know, let's listen to kids and let's not just shove something down their throats, but let's, you know, make them a part of the process and respect them in the process.
The other big part of our value system has been around building our team. So we, from day one, have had a philosophy that you have to have a healthy team to produce a healthy product. And that means that we hire folks from the communities we serve. Many of them are parents and family members of the students we serve in schools. We've tried to provide sustainable wages. We've tried to provide health benefits all along the way, medical, vision, and dental. And, you know, something very unique about Revolution Foods is that we have always offered equity and ownership to everyone on our team. So from our production chefs to our drivers to our school account managers to our dishwashers to our CEO and CIO, we all have a share and a skin in the game, if you will, in terms of building this company and really being part of something bigger than just a paycheck, which is very important. We all need to pay the rent. But we want to make sure that everyone on our team feels ownership in what they're building every day.
So have you ever been in a position as you've grown, either whether you're out there seeking funding or you're trying to sell your meals into schools or even on the retail shelves, where you've been asked to compromise those values?
What's happened in terms of building a quality brand that stands for not just access to healthy food for all kids and families, but also trust around ingredients, food quality, kid-designed food, is that that's become our brand. So when we think as a company about where do we look to cost save, where do we look to invest, I mean, every company thinks about those things. We fundamentally, and I speak for us as well as all of our investors and supporters from foundations to our investors, believe that keeping those ingredient standards sacred is part of our trust and our brand promise with the families and communities that we serve. And so if we were to make a decision that compromised that trust, we would ultimately be not only compromising the health of our kids and families, but also compromising the ultimate value and brand promise of the company. So that's, I always say, our values have become our value in many ways. And that's very important, and to stick by what we stand for multiple reasons.
And I think that's reflected in our team also, where we've created with a growing company, we've created a lot of opportunities for people to grow. So even if somebody starts as a, part-time employee, they have an opportunity to grow and learn and, become a part of a management team if they want to. And we've had so many success stories of that happening. And I think that's another area where I think we've seen the overall impact to the value of the company of having people grow and, grow internally and not just always having to hire supervisors or managers from the outside. Yeah. I think there's a real value in that, in kind of creation of job pathways for folks too.
Kristen, there are lots of companies right now who have put diversity on their to-do list. It's one of the initiatives they've created for their company, both from a gender and a race standpoint. Where does Revolution Foods shake out from that standpoint?
So I think from a diversity standpoint, it's interesting. I mean, we're actually very proud to say that over 50% of our team at the manager and above level are women or people of color. And my advice to those companies is hire the face and the composition of the team that you want, because what happens when you're obviously a company, founded by, in our case, women and moms, you tend to, attract a lot of folks who feel like that's a fantastic environment for them to be in. We have really focused on hiring people who reflect the communities we serve. And so we've done that from day one, which in turn has created a large and robust talent pipeline of folks who are of diverse profiles. So I think the best advice that we found on this front, and granted, it's happened a little more organically for us because of who we are and because of the communities we serve, but is design the face and the composition of the team that you want, bring them in, and then, they use their networks and attract folks who create a diverse workforce. And that's worked for us. And it's actually not just great to say it's diverse, but we feel like it really contributes to the quality of the offering, the quality of support, the quality of everything we're doing in the communities we serve.
And how does it contribute to that outcome?
Well, I think when we're working with the students we work with across our communities, to have folks who are parents and families in those communities, I mean, I'll just say when I'm producing a meal for my child every day, which happens quite often, I'm always thinking harder about the quality of what I'm serving my students. And I think we've always, or my kids, and I think we've always thought that, if we're employing families as part of our workforce, we're going to have just better attention to the quality of the product, in our case, the meal that's being served every day.
So let's talk about getting funding. Your company is still privately held. You've
yes.
got a variety of funding sources. The statistics show that, at least from what I've read, that VCs, venture capitalists, are more likely to fund startups with male founders than with female. I've read it's a ratio of 10 to 1. The numbers tend to vary, but it seems like the odds are definitely not in a woman's favor. As you went out for funding, what kinds of reactions did you get initially?
We got good reactions, and we've had a lot of success with our funding base and have been fortunate to attract just fantastic investors to the mix who've helped us build our company every step of the way. And I think one of the reasons Kirsten and I do spend time talking about how to put together a plan when you're an entrepreneur, how to get a plan funded, how to maintain great relationships with your investors and your board, et cetera, is because we want more female entrepreneurs to go for it and make that ask. And I think there are a couple fundamentals that have to be in place, whether you're a man or a woman. And that is, you know, you have to have a great vision and a great plan and be passionate about it. You have to be addressing a large market and market opportunity, which we certainly had. And you have to have your financials in shape. You've got to be able to talk about what the business model looks like and why it will be financially successful. But we definitely want to encourage more entrepreneurs and specifically more women entrepreneurs to go for it, because there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of great funders out there.
Do you think that it was just coincidence that one of your first funders was female?
Well, our first funder, DBL at the time, Bay Area Equity Fund, was very focused on funding companies that created great job opportunities and economic development in low-income areas. So from a mission perspective, Nancy and Mike Dorsey at the time were just a perfect match for us. And sure, I think there probably was, you know, a great connection there in terms of being, you know, aspiring women entrepreneurs and moms at the same time.
So as a woman-founded and led company, do you think that this has led to decisions or innovations in the company that would not otherwise happen?
I think that we have always built the company with sort of good leadership practices in mind. And I think that, you know, it's treat your employees well, respect them. We have very high expectations, I think, of our team. But in return, we, you know, value our employees a lot. And that goes from, you know, top management all the way to the folks delivering our meals every day and making the food every day. So I think for us, it's just been about building a really respectful environment with our workforce and, you know, creating policies that work for everyone. And I don't think there's anything necessarily that we're doing that's unique to us being women, but I think we're trying to sort of put in place the best sort of leadership practices that we know how.
The one innovation I would speak to outside of the employment practices is just the way we design our food. So I think it's been a real journey becoming a parent, whether you're, in our case, we're women, but you become a parent as a man as well. And I think the journey of becoming moms and being in the business of designing healthy, delicious food for kids, I think has certainly led to, you know, a lot of innovative thinking in terms of how we work with kids and listen to kids and build that into our design process.
Right. You've got a really emotional core around this topic because you're living and breathing it every
day. And we
get
the parents. Challenges, too. I mean, we get the challenges, and we're realist. We're pragmatic. We're relentless learners. We've, you know, made many mistakes. We've iterated again and again when we make mistakes. And I think more than anything, Kira and I embrace being just a relentless learner and not being afraid to fail, not being afraid to have to pivot, reflect, try a new approach. That's something that I think has helped us succeed as entrepreneurs. Because it's not an easy journey for sure, but it's a fun one.
We're talking to Kristen Richmond and Kirsten Tobey, co-founders of Revolution Foods. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point. We'll be right back right after this. You're listening to Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. My guests are Kristen Richmond and Kirsten Tobey, co-founders of Revolution Foods. Kirsten Tobey and Kristen Richmond, you met at and got your MBAs at Haas. And I'm hearing you talk about your management style and the things that you've needed to learn how to do in order to run your business successfully. Did you feel like at Haas you had good role models for this?
Well, so I would say on the management skills and the team building side of the business, this is something that I firmly believe you learn by doing. And you learn it two ways. You learn by building a fantastic team of great managers and leaders and working with them, learning from them, really practicing and reflecting on your skills day in and day out. And then you learn by doing. I mean, this is something that is hard to learn in business school or from a textbook. You learn it through mentorship. You learn it through great partners on your team. That's how we've learned.
Anything to add, Kirsten?
I was just going to add that I think that the sort of foundation that we built at Haas was incredible. We built an incredible network of people that we've gone back to who've connected us with funding sources, who've helped us with sort of strategic decisions. And, you know, we go back there all the time still to we get groups of MBA students to do projects with us. So I think that that sort of network and foundation that we built there, I don't think Revolution Foods would be where it is today without that. But I think I totally agree with Kristen that some of the just hardcore skills of building a company are not taught in business school. It's and can't be taught in business school. You have to learn, you know, trial by fire.
Just get in there and make a few mistakes.
and Lauren, it was very funny in our second year of business school. I can remember going through my schedule with Kirsten, and we looked at our new business finance class with Mario Rosati and our social entrepreneurship class with Will Rosenzweig and Kelly McElhaney, and our product development our class with Sarah Beckman. And so these foundational skills around putting the business plan together absolutely came from, you know, working together and with our mentors at Haas. The on-the-job management is the part that comes through building a team.
So your partnership is still going strong, clearly. Let's start with Kirsten. How do you keep your relationship with each other healthy?
I wouldn't say it requires a lot of work for us. Like, we just, I think, are very complementary to each other in a lot of different ways in terms of our skill sets. We have a lot of respect for each other's skill sets and opinions. And I think that we both have a very similar set of sort of underlying fundamental values and at the end of the day, it all comes down to fundamental values when you're, you know, making decisions, when you're, you know, making big strategic choices, all of those kinds of things. I think we're very aligned in our values, although we're different in personality and skill sets, and we have a lot of respect for each other's abilities and skills. And I think that we've crafted roles of leadership in the company that speak really well to each of our individual skill sets. You know, in some ways it's like a marriage where, you know, you do have to make sure you're communicating openly and not harboring resentment and, you know, all of those things. And I think we're pretty darn good at that.
As far as, I mean, so from your standpoint, Kristen, how does the partnership work for you? What makes it hum?
I mean, I really think Keir covered it. This is where 10 years of working together, we just can almost finish each other's sentences, to be honest. It's a little spooky, but spooky in a good way. I mean, we just respect the heck out of each other. And it just, I just feel lucky every day of the week to be partners with Keir. And I think we have also just had each other's back when it comes to, you know, building the company, when it comes to, you know, having become moms and trying to be really good family members as well as founders and C-level executives. I feel like we respect each other, we trust each other, and that's really the foundation, and our team knows that as well.
I'm wondering if you feel a special responsibility for helping other women succeed. So, you know, you've had a lot of opportunities to grow your business. I mean, you're now in a position where you can impact another person's life. So do you feel a special responsibility for helping other women succeed?
Definitely. I think for me, I'm very drawn to helping entrepreneurs and definitely, you know, a special asterisk on women entrepreneurs for sure, be set up to make the same ask and the same, you know, lay the same foundation that we've laid, and anything to inspire that confidence, inspire the actual technical planning of what that takes is something that I'm extremely committed to and spend a lot of time both working with folks on specific planning as well as teaching and leading lectures and contributing in any way possible. And obviously, time prioritization is always a question, but I absolutely feel drawn to that. Absolutely.
What about you, Kirsten?
I don't see a lot of difference between, you know, the need to inspire social entrepreneurs, you know, mission-based entrepreneurs and women entrepreneurs. I think, you know, we've wanted to make sure that, you know, we're setting an example that that it's possible to start a business that balances, that includes both a positive sort of social mission and impact, as well as a, you know, positive financial return for investors. And being women in the process of doing that is I think, great. And, you know, it's always nice to hear stories of, you know, if women have been inspired by our story or that sort of thing. I do think that the area that's very specific to women is sort of when is the right time to have kids. And we get asked about this a lot. And, you know, I think one of the things, Kristen had her first baby a year before I had my first baby. And the advice that we were given at that time, which I think is really good advice, is there's no good time to have kids. And so don't wait until you think it's the right time, because there is a biological window when your body is most, you know, ready and able to have kids. But also don't take the whole burden on yourself. If you're doing it with a partner, expect your partner to be bearing a good, you know, decent part of the burden of raising those kids. And I think that's the advice that I always give to other women who are like, when is the, you know, how do you start a business and have kids at the same time? My answer is always, don't take the burden on just yourself. You know, enter into parenthood as a partnership. And we should be asking the same question, or men should be asking the same question as women are asking around when's the right time to have kids. And I think we should enable and empower men to be able to have those conversations about work and life and balance and kids in the same way that we sort of expect women to have those conversations.
What would you say to male managers? How can men be better managers for women?
I guess I think there's sort of a fundamental set of good management skills that I would like to see all managers embody. And that's, you know, understanding and knowing your team. It's, you know, managing to high expectations and communicating clearly. Like, I think those three things make for a good management relationship between whether you're, you know, man managing a woman, or a woman managing a man, or you know, all, any of the other combinations. I think that just good, solid communication, high expectation, and you know, knowing your team members, not just sort of blindly, you know, asking for things without getting to know. I mean, it could be that something is conflicting with something on the personal level of their, you know, being a parent, or it could be that it's, you know, you're asking somebody to do something and it's their birthday and they have plans. Like, there's all kinds of things that just building a strong relationship between manager and person being managed that cross gender lines, cross, you know, all the different kinds of sort of diversity lines that you can imagine. But I think open communication and building strong relationships are probably the, you know, some of the most important management and leadership skills, regardless of gender.
Kristen Richmond, Kirsten Tobey, co-founders of Revolution Foods, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Lauren.
That's our inflection point for today. We invite you to tell us your story, suggest a guest you'd like to hear from, and more at our website, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.